Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, we're back with Digital Divination, Episode 5. And here we are recording, and we just finished up a week of PaizaCon online last week.
Phew.
And I'm pretty beat. I GM'd 5 games, I played 2 games, and then I spent half a day, one day, and all day, another day, wrangling Paizo panelists to make sure that they were showing up on time and had proper sound checks for all the recordings that we did with No Direction of all the panels at PaizaCon, so everybody could see them later. What about you? How was yours?
It was also exhausting. I mean, I was on 2 panels. I moderated one of them, and then backstage moderated the second one I was on. One of the things that was really cool is a lot of the Paizo employees had Ask Me Anything threads, where people mm-hmm. could literally come in and say, you know, what do you, you know, hey, can I see pictures of your chickens? Or, you know, what did you feel about, you know, this situation when you were writing this adventure? And it was, it was a lot. It was a lot to pay attention to. I think we, as Paizo, were very happy with how it turned out. I mean, the number of attendees was 4 times bigger than any PaizoCon we've ever held. So it was just a lot of people. We got a lot of very, very positive feedback. Far more, I think, than the negative feedback. And even the negative feedback are things that we have a good idea how to address or improve as we move forward. The timing was the most exhausting part of it, I think, is because at the same time, PaizoCon was going on and everybody was focused on this virtual event that we had to do because of the pandemic. We also had the protests and riots that were sort of rocking the nation at the same time.
Yeah, I'm glad you kind of brought that up. It's the kind of thing I was so busy with busy running stuff at PaizaCon. I was only kind of catching snippets of what was happening. You know, at the start of it, obviously was the death of George Floyd that kind of precipitated a lot. And then all through the week, we were seeing first riots in Minnesota and then, you know, in Seattle and then Chicago, where you were from. And I think one of the things that really drives home for us is kind of while we're doing a lot of the stuff here online and we're living in this other world, having fun, there's still this reality of big social issues that are driving other aspects that are very important to us. And, you know, for me, this really hits home as I'm a person of color, formerly a federal law enforcement officer. I have 2 biracial children, and I think this is a very important movement, and we don't want to downplay that importance. Obviously, we're not for the wanton destruction here, but we understand the outrage that is leading this. And I really think we're on the precipice of something big and hopefully some big social change.
Oh, I absolutely hope so, right? I think that we're seeing a lot of real serious outrage. This is part of the reason PaizoCon was really exhausting for me, is because I was paying very close attention to this. I've got two of my children are Black and one is biracial. And that means that not only am I doing my best to stay informed, stay involved, and be participating in this change, but I'm also trying to interpret and in some way shelter the actions that are going on that are oh so important that my kids need to know about, but it has to be presented in a way that 12-year-olds and 9-year-olds can understand. And that's hard. That if anything was the most exhausting part of it.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I'm fortunate. My children are a lot older, so they're adults, and they've had to navigate a lot of this already, and they've kind of come to grips with it. And for you, I mean, they're just now, you know, getting this very, very deep experience in what change is going to look like. And I for one think it's going to be, I'm hoping it's going to be a lot better for them as they get older.
Oh, I do too. And I'm doing what I can now to to move into that. But that said, I mean, we talked about PaizoCon being exhausting, but from the game side of it, I think it was fantastic. I think it was a lot of fun. I didn't play in any of the games, but I had a friend of mine who was going through a game that I wrote and doing like a live chat as he went through. So I committed my 5 hours of time for that chat, 4 hours of time as he was going through. He's like, and now we've got this encounter. I'm like, you'll love the next one then. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's cool. You know, I really enjoy going to in-person conventions. I went to 9 of them last year and get a chance to meet people from all over the country and sometimes all over the world. And for this one, with the 7 games I was involved in, it was really neat. You know, people from Argentina, a bunch of people from the UK, Canada, different parts of the US. It's very enjoyable. And one of the things I notice at conventions in person and also this one online is kind of a lot of the neat things people do with their characters. And, you know, for me, I really know a certain bit in my local group, all kind of approach things the same way. But as our characters get to higher level, there's so many more options out there. And I was seeing some really, really cool stuff. And so one of the things I thought we would talk about today is kind of what classes and characters we like to play and maybe how that varies from, you know, when you first start out to kind of now where, you know, the high level we have is really mid level. And then, you know, we had an opportunity to do a little bit of testing at the upper level, and we can maybe address that as well. So I thought maybe that's where we would go today.
That sounds great. I'd like to pick up on one of the things that you talked about, which is sort of what classes you like when you start versus what classes you like when they're, you know, very high level, you've been playing a while. One thing that's really struck me about Starfinder, one fun thing about its balance is in, you know, D&D or games like that, like, oh, well, you're just starting out, just play a fighter, right? That's the easy, mm-hmm. straightforward one. A soldier is kind of not like that, right? Soldiers, even out of the gate, have a lot of different techniques they can use that really change how they fight. And the higher level they get even more options like that. I mean, they are really the fighters in that that's what they're good at is the combat. But being able to build in so many different options as you advance makes them really kind of a class that takes some skill to play, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because when we were starting our Dead Sons campaign, Rob was going to – I wanted to play soldier, and Rob wanted to play soldier. And because when I had played – so Rob was in my D&D group when I was a kid growing up, and he always got stuck playing the cleric. And so when we were starting to play Starfinder, you know, he said, oh, I was thinking I might play soldier. And I said, you know what? We always made you play the healer before. You can play, if you want to play soldier, you can play soldier, right? Because we were, again, just starting out with this brand, you know, this is in August, right after Gen Con, where they launched Starfinder. We had no idea about it. And so, like for me, I used to play a lot of fighters and stuff. So I thought I'd go ahead and give it a shot. Anyway, he decides to play a fighter. And so we start getting into things and we realize that he's not playing a frontline fighter. He's playing a ranged fighter. And, you know, that's the way that the class he was building was set up, you know. So it's like, oh, there's different flavors of fighters here. And maybe he isn't the frontline tank that we kind of expected and that I was expecting to build. He built a completely different fighter. So it's interesting that when you see somebody with a class, you have no idea what that, you know, there's no true stereotype in Starfinder of what that class is all about.
Oh yeah, I think that's true. And I know that when we talk about these digital divinations, we opine a little bit, then we get to some patron questions or people that have posed us questions near the end. But this is a great entry into a question that that we saw that came in which is really along the lines of, are technomancers and mystics basically the sort of the wizards and clerics of Starfinder? And I think definitely no, right? Especially with the latter. I think technomancers do map fairly well to wizards with the expectation of the kind of spells they're going to cast and the kind of things they're going to do, although they're certainly no slouches in combat. But mystics have an incredible amount of versatility. I think if you're assuming that the mystic is the default healer, You actually can be quite surprised. You can make some exceptionally blasty mystic types or mind controlling mystic types. I think there's a lot more variety than you'd expect from a typical, fantasy RPG cleric when it comes to the Starfinder mystics. And I think that's a real strength of the class.
Well, I think one of the things that allows that is the fact that you don't need a dedicated healer in Starfinder. And in fact, the way healing is kind of set up, with the two different damage pools, a stamina pool and a hit point pool, having a mystic who does primarily hit points isn't really necessary. And so, to that mind, I have a mystic, kind of a mid-level, it's a level 9 mystic, and it is pretty much a combat caster. It has very little healing capability. It goes out there and blasts stuff. So,
So you've got the throw force disc and all the other, cosmic eddy and all the awesome things that mystics can do at high levels to really mess up the enemies.
Yeah, and it's actually it's kind of fun. Now that said, this past week I was playing with a woman from the UK who had made a mystic, and she used one of the alternate class setups from the comm manual, which is the medic. And when I saw some of the stuff she did, I was actually GMing the game. It was a Cornered Rat 2-24, which is kind of the season 2 climax. So there's a really big fight and all kinds of stuff in there. Okay. And at least I think that was the game. Now I'm going to look. I'm pretty sure that was the game. Anyway, no, it was a different game. It was a 7-10 that I did. Anyway, but she had some additional abilities that allowed her to heal not only hit points, but also stamina. And she was built basically to cover a lot of the stuff that maybe you would expect to see a mystic do and an envoy do. And she had no real offensive ability. Literally, during the middle of a fight, she would sit in the middle, wait for people to get injured, and then channel everybody.
And so, that is an envoy thing, right? Restoring stamina seems to be, in my experience, is more of an envoy thing than a mystic thing.
Right. But the way this alternative class feature allowed with the medic is if anybody's in the hit points, that basically any healing that goes beyond healing all hit point damage rolls over to stamina for this particular archetype. So it was really pretty effective. Now, the interesting thing is, getting back to your initial point, this is more like your traditional cleric, yet this was a very unusual mystic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I guess you could sort of say, what you're saying is she sort of used all of the tools that are available to the mystic in order to sort of spoof the classic fantasy cleric.
Correct.
Oh,
that's,
wow.
That's the role that she decided to build it. And whereas a lot of people, when you see them, they kind of do the reverse. They take this basic, healing ability, and that's a little part of it, but then they branch out and do a lot of other stuff with it. So my particular mystic is a star shaman, so he's actually a pilot, and he casts magic missiles and has lots of other offensive attacks. So,
Oh, yeah, that's pretty. And I actually, this says a little something to me I hadn't realized until this conversation right now. I generally prefer supporting and buffing type characters. That's the kind of classes that I like to play, or the ones that are helping other people do their things more awesome. And so I naturally gravitated towards the envoy in Starfinder. I quite like bards in fantasy, but the envoy really sort of scratches that itch for me. And when I thought to myself, well, I actually usually in fantasy games prefer clerics. Why haven't I been, really sort of, just really dug into the mystic? And it's because the mystic is a little more wizardy, right, to me. I guess that's the feel, is that it's inspiring for me to know that there's this calm build, because that's the first thing I've heard that's made me think, yeah, maybe I can do a mystic and play the way I like and do the buffing and the healing and the so on. That's fun.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because in our AP where you were playing the envoy, you were pretty much a frontliner. So,
if you couldn't be throwing out the damage with shots, then when your turn rolled around, you kind of didn't necessarily have a whole lot to do. So, yeah, part of that is that an envoy's abilities, especially when you get higher level, only take up your move action. So you right. can still contribute in an attack sort of way.
Well, and I, you know, switching gears a little bit to envoys, I really like the envoy a lot. So, you know, we have a couple of different flavors. Like the flavor you were playing was kind of a buff flavor mm-hmm. in that particular game. Like you had hurry, but you did not have inspiring boost. You were not kind of the healer type on that,
right?
I played kind of a mixed one that did. So I have two envoys right now that I'm playing in society play. One of them is a level 11. The other one's a level 5. And so with the level 11, I went through. I kind of did the traditional, have some buffing and stuff, and then I branched off a little bit into what I'll call an attack envoy, where they have this ability called Clever Attack, where you can basically flat foot an opponent as part of your attack. So similar to like the trick attack of the operative. But
of the operative. That's very operative-y.
It doesn't do the extra damage, though. You know, so you get the flat footing, and it enables you to get an attack, and it helps your party. Now, if there's an operative, well, that operative's probably flat footing all day. Well, then they can put a different debilitation on them. Right, so that's kind of one flavor, and then what we see in our AP with Scott is the demoralized one, right? Kind of a debuffing one,
yep.
where they go in there and they can shake them and do other things, and that's what I'm actually building my second operative for, you know, where he can go in and try to shut down somebody. So, just given this little experience here, you know, we're seeing 3-4 different types of things that you can do with an envoy.
I don't know. Now I've only just stepped into running the Dead Suns game that we're in with this fourth adventure.
Dawn of Flame, yeah, with Blind
City. That's a lot of fun to be. You know, I've just stepped into the fourth adventure of Dawn of Flame, and that's been great. But I see now when you've been running it for the three adventures before. It is almost certainly the case that you had to learn the same way I've already had to learn that whatever the opponent's numbers are, you got to think two less than that most of the time. Because you're going to spend an awful lot of time shaken from Scott's envoy doing his intimidate.
Yeah, but one of the things you pointed out, especially in this last thing, is you know the opponent we had was that operative. And man, operatives can be really, really tough.
Yeah. I think playing an operative as a player always makes me feel very satisfied that I'm contributing both from a damage perspective or a skills perspective and so on. And seeing one go against the party and just the sheer damage output is pretty amazing. It's actually, it makes me wonder whether or not operatives are too good in the game.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I think at the low levels, so once an operative hits fourth level and maybe fourth until around ninth, it really shines because, you know, the capability to have the debilitating tricks and then at seven mil to take 10 on its attacks and skills and things. But one of the things I've seen as other classes get 10, 11, 12 is, man, the soldier and the Salarian, their damage output really scales pretty high, whereas the operative starts to kind of taper off a little bit. And the other thing is, if you want to shut down an operative, and this is something that I saw quite a bit in the games this past week, man, if you can get somebody to cast a slow spell on an operative, it's done. Because basically they get staggered. They only can get a move action or a standard action, so it takes away their trick attack. And when you can take away the trick attack from an operative for whatever reason, you know, by whatever means, that really, really limits you quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm inclined to think that that's something that holds true even to the very highest levels, because when we were doing the playtest for Dominion's End, it's the last of the Devastation Arc adventure path that I wrote, did a playtest at 18th level to walk through some of the first few encounters in that, just to make sure they're kind of straight in my mind as an author, that they kind of work the way I intended. And I learned an awful lot. We just had all the characters for our Dawn of Flame party advance up to 18th level and then go and let's give it a try. And the thing that really surprised me about the operative that you were playing in that, John, is not the damage output, because you're right. You know, Kaholo, the Salarian, Jilakashti, the soldier, they seem to be the ones who had ridiculous amounts of damage that they were flinging around. And I have to say, in that regard, I was a little worried that some of the foes I'd made up using the monster build guidelines are like 300 hit points, 360 hit points. I'm like, ooh, that feels like an awful lot. But then when any single swing from Kaholo or Jilakashti does 45 hit points, that's they go pretty fast.
Low end.
That's like their average, you know, they're not very good hits. But the thing that impressed me about the thing that really struck me with the operative wasn't the damage output, but just the way that any of the skill checks an operative can just crush. They've got all the skills, they've got big bonuses on them. And the DC, even a DC that's sort of that's actually really high for everybody else, is well within reach of an operative.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I remember when I leveled up my character, basically I had so many skill points that I had to figure out what was I not going to max out. And I think only I had mysticism, I didn't max out, and there may have been one other skill, but everything else had maxed out. And I didn't max out mysticism only because we had a mystic and I didn't want to be making those rolls too, you know? But yeah, just so many skill points, because as an operative, you get 8 base, plus you get a couple freebies for your operative specialization, plus you get the ones based on intelligence. And outside of dex, intelligence becomes a pretty important skill stat to pump. So, you know, by the time you get to 18th level, you're getting just tons and tons of stats. Now, that said, one of the things I saw this past week, that, you know, I had my 12th level operative and we had, you know, a couple 12th level mechanics and things like that, that you can build out if you're a specialist as a mechanic or something, you can build out to have a higher max in a couple things than an operative would. But across the board, the operative just has many more things that they're pretty good at. Same with an envoy. The envoy will have a higher max clearly on the things that they can roll their expertise die on, but the operative has just got more really good skills across the board.
Yeah, I think that's been kind of a neat thing. Now that I think about it, I don't think I've ever seen a mechanic. I think there was a mechanic at a couple of society games I played, right? But I haven't ever had one in either of the two long-term campaigns I've run. And even though I've got those characters plus some society characters I've played, I've never played a mechanic. So yeah, it's something I'm really interested to see how a mechanic could go now that I think about it.
Yeah, I have two mechanics right now. One of them is an exocortex mechanic who's like level 7. And then I just started another mechanic who's actually a weapons specialist from the comm, using that. So it's interesting. They're really good at certain things as you get to higher levels. You know, I think at the lower to medium levels, there's a lot of, they don't really shine too much. You know, like my low level mechanic doesn't have really great skills, doesn't do great damage, doesn't have really great feats and things. But as you're getting to, you know, level 7 and above, and you start getting a remote hack and other additional abilities where you can affect things in a lot easier way than anybody else to do stuff, then I think it becomes a little bit more powerful. And then, like, one of the mechanics that we played with that just hit 13th after the end of the game I was in, you know, basically that character, he could hit this armory thing. Basically, he could create any weapon any weapon you needed up to level instantly, you know, a portable armory.
Wow.
And,
you know,
and so he did not carry a weapon himself. But somebody needed a weapon, he could just go make a weapon for him, you know.
That's pretty neat. That's really cool. One thing that struck me when we were doing this high level play, and this is the case sort of across all the classes, is that damage resistances seem to be a baked in necessity in the game, right? You're gonna be able to pick up either class abilities like the Salarian does to get, 10, 15 or more points of resistance to elements like cold or fire or damage reduction. You can get that from feats and things like that. It's, but even some of the straight up class abilities sort of lead into the thinking that at high level play, nobody should be taking all the damage from everything, right? There's always, mitigate that. That seems to be the real thing about high level play. And because we'd had people scale up their characters very quickly, it's like, oh, you're a fourth level now, make 18th level. I think everybody did. I'm really pleased everyone was really game to do that. But I think Rob was the one that just had overlooked those feats or abilities. And so was sort of very obviously unprotected in a way that everybody else had sort of built themselves to be protected.
Yeah, I think between, having energy resistance kinetic, so it's a feat that you can get at what your BAB is up to 5, that a lot of people who are going to be at frontline take that. Even my operative, even though I wasn't a frontliner, I would take that. Also, there are armor upgrades, that allow you to do stuff. And so, for example, you can get a force field that has fortification on it at the higher level, that where you can get 20, 40, 60% chance to eliminate a critical hit with fortification, So as you get to higher level, there are certain things that are become really important to mitigate all the damage that you're doing. Because, as you said, there's a creature that has 350 hit points, probably, is going to be one-shotting damage is probably going to be 60 to 80 per hit. And so a crit on that is going to probably take half your hit points.
Yeah. Yep.
So, when I was playing, we played a 9-12. So this is when I was a player in the Cornered Rat, went against the final boss who has a lot of hit points. Basically, I took 2 hits and one more hit, I was going to be dead.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, and my operative is pretty well set up with gear, and it's like, could not go toe to toe. It was like, that was a tough boss.
Wow. Well, it seems like then you've got a fight where it knows what capabilities people are going to have at those levels and assumes that they have led into them. And I think the system as a whole has a some level of system mastery that assumes you're going to need to get that or know that, no matter how you get it, right?
But I think one of the things that I'm seeing now is it's not just the equipment and stuff, but really a lot of classes and abilities that can debuff, that can reduce the number of attacks, that can reduce their damage, that can reduce their probability to hit. Those sorts of things that you can get from different classes actually play really big role. A lot of those are class abilities and things rather than equipment based, though there's a lot of equipment that allows some as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I guess when I mentioned earlier that I hadn't really seen a mechanic, I hadn't really played a mechanic, one of the things that I'm excited about seeing whenever I get into a new class, and this is one of the things that was very exciting for me to be going through the comm and seeing all the new options there, is what is this now going to be like as far as its abilities, how they flip that or invert that, knowing Starfinder like I do, but not knowing every class, how do the classes fit into the Starfinder play? I mean, for example, I was very pleased to see a ranged Solarian version. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a pleasant surprise in comm.
Yeah, we actually, in one of my other groups, we have a fellow who's playing a ranged Solarian. And it's kind of interesting because traditionally you see the Solarian, and this is actually one of the questions one of our patrons had asked about Solarian. Traditionally you see just the weapon Solarian because the damage output is just so high. And this ability now with the ranged Solarian enables you to not just have a strength-based Solarian, to be able to buff up some other useful things like dex, which can help you in a lot of other ways. I think it adds a little more versatility. Now, the issue with the Solarian is, for the weapon Solarian is you have to basically have to have charisma, you have to have strength, and typically you got to put some probably into in constitution as well in order to be a viable frontliner. Now with a ranged Solarian, you could probably go with just dexterity and charisma and still have pretty decent armor class, have a good to hit chance, but you're a little bit lighter on damage. So that's kind of the trade-off there.
Yeah, and I think, I have always found sort of the armor slayering to be really unappealing in that regard. There's really making the trade-offs and the fun decisions and what are my abilities going to do really sort of makes what is, I guess, sort of functionally the Jedi character, right? Let's, on the intellectual property issues, right? It seems like there are a ton of fun options for solar weapon wielding Solarians, but less for solar armor Solarians. I pointed that out actually, when I was talking to Owen Casey Stevens one time, and he pointed out, a lot of the Solarian abilities are equally good regardless of whether you have a solar weapon or solar armor. And I think that's technically true, but it doesn't feel that way to me. It feels like there are more toys for the weapon-using Solarian than the armor-using Solarian. And maybe the answer to that is have the armor-using Solarian get more toys, but I don't know if that even that is enough to sort of, sexy them up enough. I don't know.
When you're lower level, the toys don't seem very cool. The Graviton mode, the Photon mode things. But as you get towards 10, 11, and 12, you get some really cool Solarian things like Wormhole. Like, basically, you can create a wormhole from here to way over there, and your whole party can just shoot over. There's certain things that, in terms of utility, that kind of come as you get to higher level with Solarian that I think make your attacking ability, your damage-dealing ability, a little less important, but you don't see those until you get to higher level.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And it may be that some of those even come in the mid-level. But when I was doing my writing for Dominion's End, I had to take a look across all the classes. Like, okay, what are the cool things that people are going to get about 16th, 17th, maybe 18th level? Because when you're sitting playing my game that starts at 18th level, those are going to be like the newest, shiniest toys you've got. So I've got to think about, all right, well, what's it going to be like when you can cast, Wish once per day or, Warp Reality or Miracle or what have it? What's it going to be like when you can, have wormholes that let you jump right across this whole open battlefield and skip encounters entirely? How do I revise the flow of the game to account for some of these super awesome toys that people have? And it wasn't so much, as you say, how do I deal with the fact that damage is greater, right? It was, how do I deal with the fact that there are actually sort of all new abilities that people get to, read minds or break minds or make some fundamental adjustments to the environment in an encounter that is really neat. Hard to write around every possibility, of course, but really neat to see that these classes get.
Yeah, I would agree. I think at the higher levels, probably there's a lot more ability to just bypass certain things, And so if you can expect that's to be the case, then how do you adapt what you're writing so that if they bypass something here, that they don't, it's like, oh, well, there's one whole third of this section that doesn't get used. That I could see that as being really complicated. In a couple of the higher end scenarios that I've run, where somebody has like Dimension Door, it's like, well, you have to do all these things, but I have Dimension Door, I can do it all instantly. And it really does bypass some things that would have been really big, difficult challenges. And for now, we say, oh, that's great. Well, you have that ability and you decide to use it. But when you get to higher level and everybody's able to do that, every party's got that ability, then you have to put in something else then, right? You have to expect that to happen.
Right. And I think that's some of the things that makes high level play feel very high level, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, look at this, this cloud of poison gas that if we were low level would have posed a real danger. It's like, oh, well, now we've got like 8 different ways to have this not be a danger. It makes me feel like a more powerful hero.
Well, I'm really excited to see some more high level play, and especially for the Devastation arc to come out so that we can get our characters going on that. That said, What's your favorite class of the Starfinder classes?
Oh, goodness. See, that's hard because I think I would have said and may have even said in one of these earlier digital divination, I may have said, oh, it's an envoy for sure. But seeing all the different options that are out there for different kinds of mystics and, I haven't seen some of the awesome things that mechanics can do. And, hey, there's, different kinds of select. I mean, I don't know. That's a really hard question. So I don't know. There's just so much that I still feel like I haven't seen. How about you? You've done a lot more play of different character types than I have. What's your favorite?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. So I have, I have at least a dozen different characters and I've played, I haven't played the new classes. That's one thing I really, I'm trying to gear up to do. I really enjoy the versatility of the operative in that it can do lots of things. One of the things I've seen a couple of these, like the detective operative that uses bluff instead. I think, my first operative was a kind of a plain ghost operative. That's the kind of I would argue is the stereotypical operative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, hey, it's great. It does all this kind of cool stuff, but it's not as interesting. I think one of the other types, especially like a hacker operative or the detective operative where you use another ability and can go into another area, I think that is really, really cool. But the character I've been really enjoying a lot lately is actually the envoy. You kind of mentioned that. Just because of the different flavors of envoy that I've been trying here and seeing the different things you can do. I've played in other games, I've played a lot of support and buff, debuff. I play a lot of frontliner, but it's I think right now, right this minute, I think it's the envoy is who I like the most right now. Now that said, I'm looking to make a multi-class operative biohacker because I've seen a couple of those in action that are like super debuffers, and I'm thinking that might be a lot of fun.
Oh, that could be cool. Yeah, I've been looking a lot. I'm glad you mentioned the comm classes. I had sort of a love-hate relationship with the Vanguard. When I first heard about them, I thought they seemed awesome. And then when I looked at them, I was, frankly, wholly unimpressed. But the closer I look at how the rules they have interact with the game, the more interested I am to give one a shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have. I actually have 10 levels of GM credit. Society play earmarked for a Vanguard right now, and I have a name. My Vanguard's name is actually Leroy Jenkins. And so one of these days I'm going to sit down and build them out, and I'm probably only going to get to play them a couple times before levels out of what we have there. I'm thinking, I'm going to make somebody that just we can just dive in and survive, but that's what he's going to be. When I join a group and you say, who are you? I'm Leroy Jenkins. You're going to know what I'm going to be doing every single time, and you better be ready for it. So,
well, and if anybody's going to be able to get into that situation more than the once, right? Yes. Survive, it'd be a Vanguard. So
right. That's what I'm thinking. That's why it would be fun.
That's almost worse news, right? If you sat down and somebody's like, oh, who are you? Oh, I'm a technomancer named Leroy Jenkins. You're like, oh, well, they've got their one trick and then we won't have to worry about them anymore because they won't survive it. But a Vanguard, ooh, they will.
Yeah. So that's kind of that's kind of my net. I have that pet project and then doing a biohacker. I think a biohacker operative is what I'm thinking of now. I don't know about the Witch Warper. I've not been a big caster fan. I have not played a lot of casters in general. So that just doesn't appeal. I haven't figured out that one as much.
Yeah, I would play a Witch Warper before a Technomancer, I think. I've had a little bit of fun with Technomancers, but Witch Warper, the concept thrills me more, I think. So
yeah, well, the ones I saw in when we were doing the playtesting, man, they were really dominating the battlefield, and then some of those things got changed when it came out, and so I haven't seen that same – of course, I haven't seen the same level of play, right? We don't have any Witch Warpers that high a level yet in society play, so I haven't seen it. We had one that went through Dead Sons with us, and so we got to see a playtest version up to level 12, and it was really pretty powerful, But again, like I said, some things got changed once again. Hey, I heard that there's going to be another playtest coming out.
Oh, goodness, yes. Oh, man. Speaking of things that sound like fun classes, I'm not allowed to speak at any sort of...
Shoot. Okay. But it'll be a lot of fun, right?
Yeah. I mean, yep. The name of the class that has been bandied about itself makes me more excited to play this kind of character than any of the stuff that came out in Calm, right?
Oh, okay.
Anyway, all right. I won't say anything more.
Well, do you know when the playtest will start, though?
I don't. Okay. I'll look that up, but I'm okay. And I'm excited. Yeah.
Yeah. That was teased, and I thought, oh, this might be really kind of fun. So I was hoping it. Oh yeah, we can't spill the beans that soon.
People will know soon enough.
All right. Well, I think we touched base on most of the questions, from Jane and B, and covered some ground here. You know, one thing I want to let our listeners know that if they really want us to take a deep dive into something particular, we can do that. But in general, we're just kind of riffing about things that we're interested in and talking about. I think less nuts and boltsy things that you are going to get from other places already.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that if anybody, you know, wants us to go into a real deep look at how many hit points a CR10 creature ought to have, what we'll end up doing is giving the answer and then riffing about what role should that creature play in the combat, or here's some awesome creatures about that CR that I fought, and da 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 da. So we'll end up riffing regardless of the question, I guess.
All right. And one more thing I'll say is that I'm hoping we'll get one more of these in. I'm not really sure. I do have a pretty major surgery coming up here in a couple weeks, so we might end up skipping one or two shows, depending on how that goes.
All right, but we'll be back though, regardless. So
yes, we will be back.
Best wishes for recovery when we get through that. But I think we still have, you know, maybe one or two more of these before you go in, right?
Well, it would be one more. I mean,
because the surgery. Oh, that's right. That's right.
2 weeks from Wednesday. So.
Oh my goodness. So
I could do it the Monday, but I mean, we could get one out the day before, and then maybe I'll be able to get one again. I don't know. I'm not going to do it from a hospital bed though.
That's fair.
They won't like that.
That's fair.
Okay. Well, I guess that's it for this week. So. I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination.